Let us start then the final chapter of the unit. And this one is about photosynthesis. Now, remember what I said about the reciprocal relationship, which was the first slide of the last chapter. There's a reciprocal relationship between these two big processes that we're looking at in the unit. Photosynthesis is reciprocal compared to the complete oxidation of glucose. And what do I mean by reciprocal? I mean that each of those two major processes undoes what the other process does. That's why they have reverse summary reactions. Neither one of these processes happens in one step. It's many steps. But you can pretend that they happen in one step by saying that it's one shot from reactant to product. That's what we call the summary reaction. And the summary reaction for photosynthesis is exactly the reverse of the summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose, which is another way of saying each one undoes the other. All right? Let me say also, though, that photosynthesis is really important. What is the big deal about photosynthesis chemically and ecologically? What does it accomplish? Right. Carbon fixation is the big deal of photosynthesis. And what is the process of carbon fixation? What does that refer to? It's nothing about oxygen, actually. Right. Carbon fixation is the production of organic compounds using inorganic sources of carbon. Right? You have to have carbon to produce organic compounds, but in carbon fixation, what you start with is a carbon-containing compound that's not organic. Okay, only producers can do this. Ecologically, remember, there's two kinds of organisms, producers and consumers. All organisms, whether they're producers or consumers, all organisms to live need organic compounds. That's what organisms are made out of, right? The four kinds of macromolecules are organic. So all organisms need organic compounds. But the consumers of the world have to get their carbon for their organic compounds already in organic form. You know, we eat organisms. Organisms that we eat are made out of organic molecules. So we use carbon from organic sources and then we rearrange it into new organic compounds. But as consumers, we can't start out with carbon from an inorganic molecule and making it into organic. Producers can do that, though. And this is why all of the consumers in the world can't exist without the producers in the world. So consumers either eat something that is a producer, or they eat something that eats something that's a producer, or they eat something that eats something that eats something that's a producer, and so on, for however many trophic levels. Photosynthesis is, by humans, who are terrestrial organisms and therefore tend to think only about land, even though it's part of the biosphere only, we associate photosynthesis with plants, for good reason. Plants are the biggest and most conspicuous terrestrial photosynthesizers. But first of all, plants, as you know, are eukaryotes. And plants are not the inventors of photosynthesis. Photosynthesis existed for a couple billion years at least before any plants even existed, before even any eukaryotes existed. So photosynthesis was originally invented by bacteria. There are photosynthetic bacteria still, but they were the first to do it. And as I mentioned a little bit in a previous chapter, the eukaryotes that are capable of photosynthesis, like plants, for instance, conduct their photosynthesis in specialized organelles called chloroplasts. Well, chloroplasts really are just engulfed photosynthetic bacteria that survived. Remember I talked about that endosymbiotic theory of how chloroplasts came into existence, in the same way with mitochondria, but using different bacteria. So bacteria, of course, do not have membrane-bounded organelles. They're prokaryotes, but they are the inventors of photosynthesis. And what we're about to study, which we're going to do in plants as an example, which of course have membrane-bounded organelles, bacteria do it without any organelles. They have just one membrane, their plasma membrane, but they can fold it highly and do the same thing that a chloroplast does. Okay, so plants came on the scene much later, but they obviously are important photosynthesizers. They're not the only photosynthetic eukaryotes, though. There are also algae of various sorts. There are brown algae, red algae, green algae, some of them huge. They live in the ocean, bigger than trees. They are also eukaryotes, though. So they're also the ancestors of cells that engulfed photosynthetic bacteria to produce chloroplasts. We're the descendants, not the ancestors. We're the descendants of a eukaryotic cell that engulfed an aerobic bacterium capable of cellular respiration. That's why we have mitochondria. But there was no engulfing of photosynthetic bacteria, so we don't have, in addition to our mitochondria, chloroplasts. Plants and other photosynthetic eukaryotes have both. All right. There are also some. Let me remind you of the name protist. A protist is any eukaryote that is not an animal, a plant, or a fungus. Plants are photosynthetic. That's a major group of eukaryotes by itself. Animals is another group. They're not photosynthetic. Fungi is a major group. They're not photosynthetic. The rest of eukarya, collectively, are called the protists. Some of those protists are photosynthetic. Some aren't. Algae are photosynthetic protists. And then, you have the bacteria that started it all. So many groups of photosynthetic organisms, they all accomplish the same thing, which is carbon fixation to produce organic compounds. They do that, of course, for their own use. They're not trying to feed us, but that's why we can exist, by eating them. All right, slide 2. We're going to focus on plants now, but once we get into the actual process of photosynthesis, there are subtle differences only depending on species. And so really the same thing, even though we're concentrating on plants, the more or less the same thing happens in all photosynthetic organisms. But taking a plant as an example, like this tree, in a typical plant, most photosynthesis occurs in specialized organs called leaves. In a typical plant, the greenest part of the plant are the leaves. Any green part of a plant is capable of photosynthesis, though. That's why it's green, because of the chlorophyll that acts as a pigment, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. Notice, though, that locally, or at least before we made it a city, that just if you go out of the city and you're in the actual desert, most of the plants you see don't have big leaves. Most of them are cacti, where the leaves have been modified for protection. They become spines. They're not even photosynthetic at all. But when you have those spines, you still have a green body of the cactus. That's capable of photosynthesis. Anyway, for plants that are typical and do have leaves, green leaves, those green leaves are where most of the photosynthesis takes place. And each individual leaf is a more or less kind of a sandwich arrangement, where the two pieces of bread, so to speak, are layers of epithelia. There's epidermal cells forming the upper and lower piece of bread, and the whatever kind of sandwich it is, the stuff between the breads is collectively called the mesophyll, which means middle of the leaf. Meso means middle, phyll means leaf. And mesophyll cells are where the vast majority of photosynthesis takes place, because mesophyll cells are chock full, as you see one in detail here, of the green organelles, which are chloroplasts, which is where photosynthesis takes place. So the leaf looks entirely green to our naked eye, but really the greenness is not even the entire leaf, it's only some of the cells, and even the cells that are green aren't entirely green, it's specifically the chloroplasts that are green, just like you saw when you looked at them under the scopes. Okay, so you get closer up, this is just one cell, a typical mesophyll cell will have about 50 chloroplasts in it. We're looking at just one chloroplast in cartoon form here. Recall that just like a nucleus and a mitochondrion, a chloroplast is a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. So there is an outer membrane, smooth, an inner membrane that's smooth, and then a thylakoid membrane, which is highly elaborated. It's folded many times. This is a cutaway view. This looks like a bunch of separate little sacs, but it's all the same piece of membrane. And if you look at the cutaway view, you can see the insides of those sacs are actually continuous with each other. So in a single chloroplast, there are three compartments that we can recognize. There's an intermembrane space between the outer and inner membranes, aptly named. If you're looking at the space that's inside the inner membrane but outside of these green coin-like structures, that's called the stroma. Which reminds me that you should be careful with that word because of something I skipped up here on the leaf view. Stroma and stoma, S-T-O-M-A, are very similar words, but that R makes a big difference. Stoma means mouth or opening. And the pieces of bread I was referring to, these epidermal layers of cells, are waxy and waterproof. But of course, you can't be totally sealed up because photosynthesis requires gas exchange. You have to get things into and out of the cells. So there have to be little openings, and those are called stomata, the plural of stoma. Well, the stomata are just, they're not structures, they're just spaces. But they're formed because there are two cells called guard cells that can either plump up or deflate, and that's what opens or closes the stomata. But be careful with the word stoma, because that's an opening in the leaf. Stroma is a liquid fluid that's in the compartment that's inside the inner membrane but outside of the thylakoid membrane, which is the green membrane. The third compartment in a chloroplast is the compartment inside all of the green thylakoids, and that's called the thylakoid space. So you have one very elaborately folded thylakoid membrane forming all of these sac-like structures. Each individual sac-like structure is one thylakoid, but they're all connected. Several thylakoids are stacked. Each individual stack is called a granum, the plural of which is grana, and there are several stacks or several grana within one chloroplast. That's the basic anatomy. Now we can go to three, and this is a different way of looking at the summary reaction. I wrote it right to left like a standard chemical reaction when I gave it to you. And I also gave it to you in slightly different form. The summary reaction that I gave you for photosynthesis, well, what do you start with? You have to give the plant CO2, a carbon source. But carbon in CO2 is inorganic, right? That's the important part I was talking about when we talked about carbon fixation. Take six of those. What's the other thing you have to give plants? Water. And through many steps, not just one, they will turn that into sugar, glucose, C6H12O6. And as a byproduct, they'll produce six oxygens. This is how I wrote it before. Notice that's a little bit different. Here they have 6 CO2 plus 12 waters are becoming glucose, 6 waters, and 6 oxygens. That is true, actually, but you can simplify this. Since water is both a reactant and a product, you can simply subtract 6 waters from both sides and simplify it to what I wrote. But the reason that this slide is important, and with all the arrows, is that you might have guessed, I mean, you might have been wondering what the source of the oxygen that gets produced by photosynthesis is. For instance, you might say, well, there's oxygen in carbon dioxide, so the oxygen that's produced by photosynthesis comes from the CO2 that's taken in. That's not true. The oxygen that is produced by photosynthesis comes from water that you put in. Now compare this to the reciprocal process, which is the complete oxidation of glucose, right? The exact reverse of this. We take in glucose and oxygen. The oxygen serves as the final electron acceptor, so it receives electrons and protons from the fuel to become water, right? In the reciprocal process, photosynthesis, water gets split. And the reason the plants do this, I'll explain it later, is for the hydrogen. And when you remove the hydrogen from water, you have oxygen. So that's why it spits it out. The carbon, of course, has to come from CO2. That's the only carbon-containing reactant. And that gets incorporated into an organic compound. So you're taking 6 inorganic single carbon CO2s and incorporating that carbon into a 6 carbon organic compound, glucose. All right, that's carbon fixation. This is inorganic, this is organic. Only producers can do that. There's 12 waters required, but that you end up producing 6 waters. That's what I was talking about earlier. So you can simplify this, just like, you know, if I say equals y plus 5, right? I can simplify that simply by subtracting 3 from both sides to say x equals y plus 2. Similarly here, I'm just subtracting 6 waters from both sides, and it becomes this. Okay, now we can look at the process of photosynthesis in slide 4. And this looks kind of similar to the summary slide we started with for the complete oxidation of glucose, except that remember that complete oxidation of glucose with its 2 major parts happened in 2 different places in the cell, right? Glycolysis happened in the cytosol, and the rest of the process, which is cellular respiration, occurred in the mitochondria. Here, the overall process, which is photosynthesis, occurs within the specialized organelle, the chloroplast. So there is no cytosolic part that you start with. That's one thing. Another, though, is that you can see here that the overall photosynthetic process occurs in 2 major parts. And these parts have gone by different names over the ages. They used to be called the light reactions and the dark reactions. You won't find those in modern textbooks, but if you look back at old books, that's what they would call them, light reactions and dark reactions. The reason that was not good nomenclature is because if you call something the dark reactions, it implies that darkness is required, and that's not true. So that's why the better words for the 2 parts of photosynthesis are the light-dependent reactions, which is sometimes just simplified into light reactions, but the better phrase is light-dependent reactions, because those depend on light. You have to supply light. And the light-independent reactions instead of the dark reactions. But even though it's best to call it the light-independent reactions, most books prefer to call it with an eponymous name, meaning a name after some human, just like Krebs cycle. The other name for the light independent reactions is the Calvin cycle. So those can be used interchangeably, just like citric acid cycle is the same thing as Krebs cycle. Okay? Those are the two parts of photosynthesis. As far as what photosynthesis is trying to accomplish, which is carbon fixation that we've talked about, that occurs in the second part, in the Calvin cycle, the light independent reactions. Notice the input into the Calvin cycle is the inorganic carbon source, CO2. And after some processing, what gets spit out is the organic product, sugar, which is organic, of course. All right, so that's where the carbon fixation takes place. But think about what's happening here. You're starting with a... We're starting out with a bunch of simple one-carbon CO2s, and you're assembling them into a six-carbon organic compound. Therefore, energetically, what would you expect this to be? This process. Andragonic. You're assembling a big complex thing out of smaller, less complex things. You should expect that to be andragonic. And what word would you use to describe it metabolically?
Anabolic.
Anabolic. You're building up things. That's anabolism, not catabolism. When you're talking about the previous chapter, using fuel for glycolysis and cellular respiration, that's catabolic, right? And exergonic. That's the whole reason we burn our fuels, is to get the energy out. Here we're trying to build up a fuel rather than burn it. And so it's anabolic, which is the opposite of catabolic. It's also endergonic. You have to supply energy. Well, I also want you to think back to the previous chapter to compare this. Remember that ATP, which is the goal of complete oxidation of glucose, that serves as an energy currency, right? It's a middleman, so to speak, because we have all these endergonic processes that the cell has to take place, has to force to happen to stay alive, but we don't use the energy from our fuels, which is released from our fuels, directly to drive those endergonic processes. That's why we have the energetic middleman, or the energy currency, ATP. The energy that's released directly from the fuels gets put into the storage form of ATP, and then ATP gets used to directly power the endergonic processes, correct? Similarly, a photosynthetic organism isn't able to directly use the light, which is energy, to fix the carbon, to undergo this anabolic process of producing sugar. It needs energetic middlemen to do that, or middle people, I guess, would be the term. Not only one, two different energy-carrying molecules. It requires ATP to do this endergonic process of carbon fixation, the Calvin cycle, but it also requires a different energy-carrying molecule that we haven't talked about, but you can guess pretty much what it's like. It's called NADPH. We talked in cellular respiration about NADH. Well, NADPH is just like it, except it has a phosphate also. So it's a different energy. It's like a different company taxi. It's in a different fleet, competing company. A plant, never lose track, is undergoing both processes itself. It's undergoing photosynthesis to produce its food. It's also undergoing the complete oxidation of glucose to use that food. So it has chloroplast and mitochondria. It's undergoing both processes, undoing each other. Well, it uses its NAD fleet for cellular respiration, and it uses its NADP fleet for photosynthesis. So it's like not only different companies of taxis, they're operating in different parts of town, and they don't come into contact with each other, really. Now, it's not surprising, hopefully, that you need an energy input into this second phase, because that's where you're building the molecule. But it's not enough to give just one of these types of energy-carrying molecules. You have to have both kinds for different reasons. And that's why they're both shown as inputs into the Calvin cycle, ATP and NADPH. Well, when the Calvin cycle uses the energy that's arriving in the forms of ATP and NADPH, what it's going to do is turn those energy-carrying molecules into their lower energy forms. So ATP gets used partially to form ADP, an inorganic phosphate. That's how you use an ATP, right? You dephosphorylate it. And this energy-carrying taxi, NADPH, which is the reduced high-energy form, once it delivers its energy, it gets reoxidized into the oxidized form, which is NADP+. Just like the oxidized form of NAD is NAD+, the oxidized form of NADPH is NADP+. All right, so those are spent energy-carrying molecules, and they then need to get recharged into higher energy versions so that it can go back to the Calvin cycle again and allow more sugar to be produced. Where do they get charged? In the first part of photosynthesis, which are the light-dependent reactions. So the original source of energy is the light energy. That's one form of energy. We talked about energy a little bit in different chapters. And I told you that transduction is a word that refers to converting. Transduction can be conversion of one form of energy to another. Here we have transduction occurring in the light-dependent reactions because light is one form of energy. It's not usable directly to drive the Calvin cycle. But if we transduce it or convert it into a different form of energy, then we can drive the Calvin cycle. So the goal of the light reactions by themselves is to capture some of the energy that's in light. Of course, some of it's going to be wasted as heat. But capture some of that energy in the form of ATP and reduced coenzyme NADPH. And it's not shown here, but just like the reduced form of NAD is NADH, NH+, the reduced form of NADP is NADPH and NH+. So there's an H+ here too as well. Okay, now to do this, to capture the light energy and convert it into these energy-carrying molecules, requires an input of water. That's the other major input, right? CO2 for the second part, the Calvin cycle, H2O for the first part, the light-dependent reactions. The reason that it needs water and what it uses the water for is as a source of hydrogen. It's not the oxygen that it needs, it's the hydrogen, because those hydrogens are the electrons and protons that are going to get put into the taxis, the NADP taxis. All right? So a photosynthetic organism splits water to provide the hydrogens, and what's left over is oxygen. Notice this is exactly the reverse of what we do. We take in oxygen, allow it to accept electrons and protons that make hydrogen, and produce water. This is the reciprocal process. Okay, so these middlemen, ATP and NADPH, keep going back and forth between that high energy form and the low energy form, ADP and NADP+, that go back to the light reactions and get recharged just over and over. But this is the middleman aspect I'm talking about. How am I doing? Ooh. What do I have, 30 seconds? All right, remind me, I'm on 5.